providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report, I am in this segment chatting with Mark Chandler. He is a managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also writes the Mark to Market blog. That's where Mark shares his thoughts on a daily basis on economic data and key market moves. Mark, let's recap some of the key data and news that came out this week that I think we need to take in a bigger context, especially when it comes to the jobs data. The jobs number that was released on Friday, Good Friday, it was strong. We kind of got a taste of that earlier in the week, but there were a little over 900,000 jobs created. That's much higher than the estimate that was a little under 700,000. Mark, is this showing that the economy is coming back, or is this just a simple case of some more maybe low-hanging fruit because stuff is starting to reopen in terms of jobs coming back?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to frame it. It's not so much that these are new jobs being created. These are basically people returning to their jobs. And so we still are, and like you said, the March jump, over 900,000 jobs were created, people returned to those jobs, and the back months were revised higher. And so in some ways, I think that the data really confirms what we've all known. And that is the U.S. economy is accelerating. And, it still has not gotten back to its 2019 peak, either in GDP sizes measures or in terms of employment. But this seems to be a big down payment. You know, the key part of this is the Federal Reserve says that they've linked their bond buying, $120 billion worth of bonds a month, to the what they say, substantial progress towards its targets. And it's not clear exactly, and of course, officials won't be pinned down, what does that substantial progress mean? But what the Federal Reserve is going to find is when they meet in June, the U.S. economy would have created close to 3 million jobs since they met and provided their March forecasts. And this seems to be getting closer to what significant progress would be. It still leaves us, at the end of Q1, we still are about 8 million jobs shy of where we were in early January of 2020.
So do you see these jobs eventually being added back? Is this a trend that we're going to be seeing here, Mark, where jobs are continuing to be added back? Because the one problem also with comparing it to where the job market was before the pandemic is that unemployment was very low, right? And we kept hearing that the job market was saturated. Are we going to get back to that level quickly?
I think you're right. You know that on the eve of the pandemic, the unemployment levels were at the lowest in 50 years. And so I think that we're going to reach a point where those the last jobs are going to be more difficult. Partly, you think about what's happening. You know, as if we're going to be bringing back manufacturing jobs to the United States, or that's really like how politicians might phrase it. But what we're really doing is bringing manufacturing to the U.S., and that'll be increasingly automated. I think last year was one of the first years that we saw the robots being bought for robots outside the auto sector increased faster than the robots being used in the auto sector. And I think this is the future. We're going to be bringing back manufacturing capacity. That's important for all kinds of national economy, national security reasons. But it doesn't mean there's jobs that come with them. And so I would imagine we're going to see that the increase in jobs continues next several months, maybe even through the rest of this year, but then begins slowing down as we reach its own capacity like we did before.
Okay, well, something to keep an eye on, right, is this job pickup, and it really does seem like the U.S. is leading the way. So, again, when you start to come out of these lockdowns, there are a lot of low-hanging jobs that can come online, but it was a good number to end that shortened trading week. Mark, what about this infrastructure bill? Infrastructure was on everybody's mind. We finally got some bill out of the U.S. government, and I think the expectation is it's still going to take a while to pass through all the stages of government, a lot because of the tax increases. But let me just ask you broadly, did anything surprise you, or is anything extra noteworthy about that infrastructure plan?
Well, I'd say two things. One is it's what a lot of people who think of themselves as progressive. That's what the kind of vision they had. They'd want more, but this is like big steps in that direction, including Amtrak, infrastructure, not only the material infrastructure, power grids, highways, bridges, roads, broadband access. So all that very positive, I think. So I think you want to like wherever you want to like however you want to come down on it, whether it's good or bad, it is a very bold vision, especially given how what the state of these conditions is now. But the other thing I'd point out is only half of it. What we've only seen is really one half of this larger infrastructure bill. It's been broken into two parts. And the second part, people aren't talking about yet. Maybe it's a week, 2 weeks away, but it'll be like the other half of this that'll focus on schools. It'll focus on making permanent some other changes that were in the $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, earned income tax credits and child tax credits. And as well as expanding health care and expanding family leave. And so two big parts of this infrastructure. One is the material one, and that's what essentially was the what Biden has proposed last week. And then we've got this other one that's still forthcoming. And together, it's still going to look like close to $4 trillion. And even though it's going to be sort of spread out over some of it 4 years and some of it 8 years.
What's the trickle down into the markets, or even more importantly, into commodities? Do you see this infrastructure bill being enough to, A, support the aggressive move we've seen in commodities, and two, drive those commodities even higher?
Well, I think that the interesting thing that what's happening, I think, is that when I look at a lot of the infrastructure and the move to electric over the fossil fuels, it seems to me that it places a big demand on commodities that the U.S. doesn't have necessarily a lot of. And so on one hand, we all know that the fiscal stimulus is going to create these growth differentials that's going to widen the U.S. trade deficit. But I think this infrastructure bill, should it pass and should it really like begin kicking off, it'll also mean a lot of imports. The infrastructure, we think of people building roads as really domestic. But where are we going to get that asphalt from? We can have the manufacturing build electric devices, but where are we going to get the copper from? And so what strikes me about this, and this is sort of the an interesting framing of what's happened, is that a year ago, when the world shut down because of the pandemic, the commodity prices collapsed. And China looks like they came in and bought lots of commodities, and partly because the U.S. is threatening a trade sanctions, and they were afraid of being isolated, and so they needed to sort of make sure that they had secure supply chains. And secondly, they were astute and used those commodities to also rebuild strategic reserves. And so here the U.S. comes a year later and says, those commodities that China's been buying, you know, we need them too for our infrastructure. But but because of the Chinese buying, prices for a lot of, and the reopening, of course, the commodity prices have already taken off. So the U.S. is not only going to have to import these commodities for the infrastructure bill, but it's going to be paying relatively elevated prices for these compared to, say, where they've been, which is how this commodity super cycle story is still being fanned. And you can see this in a lot of the buy-side research.
So do you think then, even though commodities are broadly higher in price, do you think that means commodities continue to run higher? Or has China stepped back enough that the balance then just shifts to the U.S. to hold these prices?
Well, I think that's the thing, is how China is really the swing buyer. And so the things that I've been seeing and reading lately make it seem like China has backed off. But it's not clear why they've backed off. Has their strategic reserves reached levels that they want? There's not a lot of transparency. Or is it that higher prices, and it's just like why other people might be back off a little bit from chasing commodity prices higher? So I don't really have a lot of transparency on it, but I do suspect that there is a larger like game being played out. And it's not just about U.S. infrastructure, but it's also how the rest of the world responds. If you're a producer, maybe you'd want to also, if you're in Taiwan or in Japan, maybe you too would want to build up strategic reserves. And I think we want to consider this as part of this broader effort to rethink globalization and what we need to do for ourselves. How much do we need to be sufficient in, and how secure are those supply chains?
How much does this infrastructure bill, if passed, just go to further support the argument that governments and central banks are not afraid of continuing to keep printing money? And that is truly the story here, is that it doesn't matter what kind of bill they put out, governments want to keep on spending.
Yeah, so I do think that there is a strong push in the U.S. I also think it's fairly popular. They're not just being like government doing it, but people are sort of, I think, are quite in favor of it, like you would in general, right? But I don't think it's generally shared like this. So, for example, I think that we'll see many countries, including the Eurozone and Japan, show smaller budget deficits this year than they did last year. And so I think that's one of the reasons why I think the Canadian dollar is fairly resilient, that Canada and Norway are probably the leading candidates to pull back from some of the stimulative measures. In fact, next week, one of the highlights will be Canada's jobs data. And another robust report, I think, will sort of fan the expectations that the Bank of Canada changes its forward guidance on its buying of $4 billion worth of federal bonds a week. And so I hear what you're saying. Countries are still reluctant to pull back a lot of the stimulus. And when they are pulling back the stimulus, they're sort of like, very little. And I think people and policymakers are really scared by what happened last year and want to make sure that the economy is strong and don't want to pull away the punch bowl too early.
Do you think we are broadly seeing stronger economies, though? Is that going to continue to be the trend, not just reopening, but actually stabilizing some of these economies at higher levels?
Well, that I think is a part of the problem, right? Is I think that we could return to, everybody wants to, oh, it was in 2019, can we just get back there? And I think that the underlying challenge will remain, and that is how to really, when you have aging populations that have already been urbanized, you've got like a very wide dispersion of durable goods like cars, refrigerators, stoves. How to keep growth strong? You've got slower population growth, and I think we fall back into that, where slow population growth, slow household formation is a return to slow growth, and this fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus, it acts as a bit of a sugar buzz, but it has a finite life to it, even if we don't know exactly how long.
Yeah, that's fair. But it still sounds like there's a bit of a sugar high then for these economies. Is that fair to say that we can continue to expect at least all this easy money to somewhat support the reopening trade?
I think so. I think that we're going to see it. It's going to be stretched out too, because it's not really coordinated among the major countries. So for example, by the time that the U.S. fiscal stimulus begins wearing off, and some of the programs, like the extension of unemployment benefits, expires, that'll probably be around the time that the European stimulus, fiscal stimulus, the EU's recovery fund, can begin allocating funds. And so, and there'll be reverberations back for U.S. companies who operate in Europe from a stronger European economy. So I think this could be stretched out, and I do think we're in sort of this phase of very strong growth. Q2, Q3 of this year, maybe a little bit weaker in Q4. The year-over-year comparisons will be more difficult, of course. And I think some of the U.S. fiscal stimulus will begin wearing off. So that's why I think the next 2 quarters, 6 months, we'll have, I think, a very strong world economy. Partly the markets are anticipating it, but partly we also still trade off of headlines.
Yeah, you're right. That's what the volatility aspect is. But it sounds like reopening still on everyone's mind and still progressing, which, I don't know, to me means that the broad markets will still be supported and those calls for major crashes or a major correction still seem maybe a little premature, but we'll see how it all plays through the system because, as I've mentioned throughout the week, there are more lockdowns and restrictions that came into Canada, so it is not a smooth line for all countries, but the U.S. does seem to be leading the way. Mark, I appreciate your time. I hope that you have a very happy Easter and a good long weekend. Thanks for your time this weekend, Mark.
Thanks a lot. Good luck, everybody.